Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I am the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today I'll be speaking with Ruben Flores, an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas. His book, Backroads Pragmatists, Mexico's Melting Pot and Civil Rights in the United States, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, is the winner of the 2015 Book Award of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. Flores recasts the long U.S. civil rights movement by framing it within the exchange of ideas between Mexican and U.S. pragmatists. In a thoroughly researched transnational history, it demonstrates how post-revolutionary Mexican reformers adopted John Dewey's pragmatism and Franz Boas's cultural relativism in fostering assimilation of diverse people into a pan-ethnic republic. Mexican educators Moises Sanz and Rafael Ramirez both studied under Dewey at Columbia University and were eager to apply his philosophy at home. In turn, U.S. reformers looked to Mexico's scientific state as a living laboratory and a model for assimilating Native people and Hispanics of the Southwest and Blacks in the South into the beloved community. American educator George I. Sanchez, the psychologist Lloyd Tyerman, and the anthropologist Ralph L. Beals applied what they learned from Mexico's three-tier rural education program, administrative structure, and the concept of the Mexican melting pot to post-war school desegregation and civil rights battles in the U.S. As radical liberals, they believe in the power of government and education embodied in Mexico as effective in fostering cross-ethnic cooperation and a common vision. Flores has skillfully demonstrated how backroads intellectuals, with a mutual desire for national unity and the preservation of local differences, along with a pragmatic belief in the connection between thought and action, cross borders, and fueled civil rights gains in the United States. Here's my conversation with Ruben Flores. Now, let me introduce you to the author, Ruben Flores. I have the pleasure of having Ruben here with me. You just received the 2015 award from the Society of U.S. Intellectual History for the best book of the year. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here with your audience, and it's a great thrill to get the award.
Wow. I'm very excited for you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with my audience right now, and I love the boldness of your book. You have moved across borders and placed U.S. civil rights within a frame of the Mexican Nation Building Project, and I think it's very innovative and a creative book. But before we get into the book, tell me a little about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Backroad Pragmatists.
Well, my name is Ruben Flores. I am from El Paso, Texas. I was raised on the Ciudad Juarez-El Paso border all my life. I went to high school there and went to Princeton when I graduated. And I spent 4 years in the history department at Princeton. And I had a fabulous undergraduate teacher. Her name was Suzanne Marchand. She was a European intellectual historian. And it was through Suzanne and the exploration of some of the great works of European thought that I discovered my love for history beyond just the BA. My mom had been a little ill, and so a lot. I went back home as an undergraduate once I got my degree and spent 5 years working at El Paso before I decided to go to graduate school. But it was in that five-year period where I really thought heavily about graduate school as a career, becoming a professor, working with books as an everyday part of my life. My wife is the one who convinced me eventually to apply to UC Berkeley and the history program there. She said, you know, if you don't get back into the library and write, you're never going to be happy. I had met her in that interim period when I was back home. I went to Berkeley because it had a very strong emphasis on both Latin America and the United States as fields of history, a very rich tradition of doing Latin American history, including Woodrow Borah, for example. And the mentors that were in the department were people who focused on the one hand, the social history of Latin America, and then on the other hand, on the intellectual history of the United States. For me, those two fields blend organically because of my life in El Paso. And the question is, how do I begin unpacking and thinking analytically about these streams of life and thought that are so important to my formation? as an individual living on the border. I got to Back Road Pragmatists when I discovered that the social scientists who are responsible for the creation of the major legal cases in the American West have all studied in the Republic of Mexico after the revolution. And that's something that made absolutely no sense to me. The civil rights movement had been constructed as a domestic movement. That is, a movement in California, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. And I had never read an account of individuals studying in Mexico before coming back and becoming politically active in the United States in the 1940s and 1950s. And the question that I had to answer in the dissertation is, why were United States intellectuals from the West so interested in what was happening in the Republic of Mexico in the 30s, and why did they put that work to use politically in the civil rights cases? It wasn't just that they were enunciating the philosophies that the Republic of Mexico had created. It was also that they were institutionalizing the systems that Mexico had created after the revolution, but doing so on this side of the border in the United States.
Well, what is the main argument of your book? And what is the problem you're trying to solve? Is it just, I know you had a personal question that you just brought out, but what is the historical problem?
So the problem is, how do we organize our society in a manner that allows ethnic difference to survive, to remain culturally vibrant, at the same time that we are trying to create, in both the United States and Mexico, a single political unity called the nation. If you think about the United States, clearly we have the immigrant streams from Europe. Clearly we have the tradition of slavery. We have indigenous America. And one of the big questions in American history has always been, how do we unify all the varieties of people under a single nation? Is that a utopian dream? Is it a possibility? I think as long as we have been a civilization, this has been one of the primary questions that is foremost in intellectual thought, in political practice. I use the metaphor of the melting pot to talk about this very question. The Republic of Mexico has an analogous question, precisely because of the Spanish influence in the Republic, precisely because indigenous America is such a heavy presence in Mexico, and you really have to fragment indigenous America in Mexico into its many different types. It's not a single unit, but it's many different distinctive families of peoples.
Of course, many people in the United States think of Mexico as this monolithic ethnic nation. And as your book clearly shows, it is just probably hundreds of different ethnic and linguistic groups and villages and all over Mexico. It's not one thing.
No, this is absolutely true. And it is one of the things that many people in the United States do not understand about the Republic of Mexico. It is ethnically heterogeneous. And so, for example, there are the Maya people of Yucatan, about 3 million of them that are still present in the states of Chiapas and Quintana Roo. The Nahua people, who we know as the Aztecs, are still a vibrant ethnic group that live in the vicinity of Mexico City, the states of Morelos, the state of Mexico in Puebla. But if you go up north, you have the Rarámuri people in the state of Chihuahua. In Jalisco, there are the Huicho. There are the Otomi. There are the Yaqui. And all of these groups of people lived separate existences from one another, have completely different cultural structures. Were friendly at times past with one another, but also went to war against each other at times in the past. And so one cannot speak of an indigenous homogeneity in Mexico at all. Now, you add to that the European element, right? The presence of the Spanish who come in the 15th and 16th centuries. And you also need to add slaves who came from Africa and are to this day especially prominent in the states of Guerrero and Oaxaca. The other thing to notice about the Republic of Mexico is that the land base varies greatly. Very deep canyons, huge mountainscapes on both the east and the western sides of the country, also the south. And this is important politically because it has meant that territorially, without heavy infrastructure investment, people have been able to live lives separately from one another into the 20th and 21st centuries to an extent that is not possible in the United States. Mm. And so, for example, you still have very strong communities of Maya with political systems, with spiritual systems that are vibrant and rich. And unless you see them working on the ground, you really can't fathom how strong they remain to this day.
Now, what is the situation? What was the national situation in post-revolutionary Mexico? Talk a little bit about the revolution, what kind of ideas it brought, and how those ideas were attempted to be worked out.
The primary question in post-revolutionary Mexico was how to unite the nation as a single constituency of citizens that was able to confront the militaristic power of the United States. It was right after the Spanish-American War. It's the turn of the century, and Mexico goes to war starting in 1911. The political documents are created in 1910. A year later, you have mobilization of armies. And then you have unrest throughout the countryside that over the next 10 years, at various moments, congeal into movements against the federal state. The entire state is destroyed throughout that 10-year period. And so when we reach the end of the revolution in 1920, there is a necessity to institutionalize a new federal government. And the question for the government is, how do we organize a constitution that can encapsulate, that manifests the creation of a single citizen bloc out of so many different ethnic groups? Two, that can control the resources of the country and put the resources to work on behalf of the citizens. Here we're talking about petroleum, for example, which had been owned by the Rockefeller family until the revolution and was expropriated finally from the Rockefellers in the late 1930s. But how do you institutionalize the use of petroleum reserves to create a public school system, to create a military, to create a social welfare net that can redistribute resources internally for the benefit of the people of the country? One thing also to know about the Republic of Mexico is that poverty was at very high rates coming out of the revolution. I have read estimates of 95% of the people in Mexico in 1910 living in poverty. And so what we were talking about is economically, sort of at the level of political economy, vast inequality throughout the country. And so the question of how to redistribute the resources for the benefit of people was a very practical concern at the very moment that Mexico was being challenged militaristically by the United States. You have a global power that has expanded into Asia, into Latin America via the Spanish-American War. It's very clear that America is on its way to become a superpower. It's challenging France and Germany and England. And here's the Republic of Mexico on the doorstep of the United States. And Mexico needs to respond. How do we recreate our society in a way that unites our people and confronts the United States at the same time?
So Mexico, the post-revolutionary Mexico had a dual problem. One is, how do you unite all these different ethnic groups? Hundreds of them, and probably a lot of them didn't even speak Spanish. Is that true?
That's absolutely true.
So you've got multilingual society. It's not just multicultural, multi-ethnic groups.
Absolutely. And so this raises questions of epistemology, for example. It raises questions of spiritualism. It raises questions of how one communicates across the cultural barriers that are part of the universe in which humanists operate.
So the New Mexican Republic has this problem of trying to unite all these different groups and also distribute resources. And I thought that the way you laid out in your book, the kind of the plan, there was a strategy, and Jose Vasconcelos was very involved in this strategy of how we're going to do this. And education was key.
That's right. Education was considered the primary platform for uniting, for creating a unified Mexico out of its heterogeneity. Vasconcelos is one of the towering intellectuals in 20th century Mexico. He would eventually run for the presidency, but he had been a follower of Francisco Madero, the insurgent intellectual who overthrew Porfirio Diaz in 1910. Vasconcelos became the Minister of Public Education in 1921, after the revolution had ended. And Vasconcelos is credited with creating the institutional infrastructure within the Ministry of Public Education that began the practical, tangible process of unifying all the various ethnic groups into a single a constituency of citizens. How did he do that? He took public school teachers that belonged to the federal state and were paid by the government, and he sent them from Mexico City into the rural areas of the nation. And the purpose was to bring the Spanish language into the indigenous areas of the country. It was to work with local villagers to create public schools throughout the provinces of Mexico, all of the states of the republic. It was to begin to measure social indicators of life throughout rural Mexico. And so, for example, there were ethnographers that would go to Jalisco or to Chihuahua or to Oaxaca, and they would write about the everyday lives of the citizens of the republic. And the purpose was to use science, to harness social science for the purpose of creating a single constituency of citizens. I think my favorite question, and still an open one in the historiography of Mexico, is what did that single constituency look like at the end of the road? Had Vasconcelos been able to create the utopia that he imagined for unified country, did that necessarily mean the erasure of ethnic identity for all of the various families of indigenous Americans that were in the republic? Did it mean the imposition of a cultural structure imported from Europe onto indigenous Americans? Did it mean vice versa, the movement of indigenous characteristics of life? One can think of religion, for example, or food, or political systems, as the predominant ethic for organizing society, as against the systems of European colonizers that had historically had power in Mexico. These questions of the utopia are still open questions. And I argue in the book that there were a spectrum of possibilities that intellectuals in Mexico fought over in the early 1920s and then in the 1930s as they were institutionalizing the Ministry of Education.
Now, there was in this Mexican plan to sort of unify the nation, you had the three-tiered rural education program. You have an administrative structure that's being built, which is very important to try to manage this huge country with all these groups. And you have also the concept of the melting pot, the Mexican melting pot, which I'd never heard of the concept of the Mexican melting pot. What is that exactly? And how is it conceptualized?
We use the term melting pot here in the United States, and we tend to fall back on the metaphor of the laboratory. Think of a chemist who is blending together all the synthetic chemicals or ores into a single unit. And Mexico uses the word crisol, so C-R-I-S-O-L. And a crisol is a small vessel in which ore or chemicals get blended together. And one can think of the vessel sitting on a laboratory table, and think of the chemist, the physical scientist, working his knowledge on it in order to blend it into a single unit. The crisol as the metaphor for unification comes up very prominently in the 1920s, in the 1930s, and in the 1940s among Mexican philosophers, among sociologists, and among the functionaries of the Ministry of Public Education. You also have other metaphors. Sometimes they speak about a tapestry. And so they're thinking of Mexico as a cloth. And the question is, how do we weave all of the various fibers of the nation into a single uniform that represents the citizenry of the country from here on out? But you can see, even in the metaphor of weaving and the cloth, the necessity of retaining the constituent elements in order to create the single piece of clothing that represents the country. There are others who use musical metaphors, and so they would talk about a symphony, for example. And when I first read the work of Moisés Sáinz, one of the other intellectuals who was involved in the Nation Building Project, I was struck by the number of times that he spoke about a symphony or an orchestra. This is a metaphor that is used very heavily in the United States in the 19-teens and in the 20s. And it's associated with Jewish American intellectuals who, in New York, were also thinking about the question of the dialectic between Jewish ethnicity and American citizenship.
Yeah, so basically, right now, this is where the point where there's an analogy, there's a comparison, a commonality between Mexico and the United States, in that the United States also has issues of ethnic groups and trying to blend them together and trying to build a democracy, a social democracy that includes everyone.
That's right.
And how do you do this?
That's right.
So, but before we go into that, I have some other questions about, you didn't really talk about it. Let me go on. You're talking about some Mexican intellectuals who went to Colombia and studied with Dewey.
Yes.
Let's talk about how pragmatism and Dewey's particular vision of education and pragmatism gets picked up and gets returned to Mexico.
The use of Dewey in the book is absolutely fundamental. One can talk about the politics of the revolution. One can talk about the politics of citizenship and creating the nation. And this is at the institutional level. But behind it lies theory. These work in dialectic with one another all the time. Dewey represents a stream of thought. It is a stream of creative of original philosophical thought that was created in the United States at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And as I explain in the book, pragmatism was a critique of Western systems of philosophy. And the critique was that systems of philosophy had not been brought down to the level of institutional politics as it played out every day in the fabric of social process. And what pragmatism was arguing is that we needed to close the chasm between the systems of thought that we had created as representations of the social world and what was actually happening on the ground in the social world. It was very skeptical of talk about utopias. It was very skeptical about talk about normative possibilities, because it said that unless you tested a real-world experience against those systems of thought, that perhaps the systems of thought were actually bankrupt, that they did not in any way reflect the movement of social process, the movement of constituencies of people, the conflicts that were everyday conflicts of social process, adequately enough. And they didn't speak to how to break out of those conflicts in the attempt to create some utopia at some point in the future. Moisés Sáenz is a very interesting case. He was a Protestant intellectual from the far north of Mexico. His family resided in the city of Monterrey, a very, very wealthy Mexican family. They were partisans of the revolution. And as part of the nation-building project after 1920, they wanted to harness the wealth of their family to create industry in Mexico for the purpose of rebuilding the nation, as an element in the rebuilding of the nation. Simultaneously, however, Moisés Sáenz knew that what needed to happen alongside was the creation of a vibrant public education system, of a vibrant political system that included a room for public government to redistribute the resources that would be created by industry. We don't know why Moisés Sáenz decided to go to New York to study with Dewey and to study pragmatism. But if you think to yourself, if you just take one step back and think practically, even theoretically, about what would have made him latch onto the notion of pragmatism, you can understand why Mexican intellectuals would find pragmatism so appealing. It is because the systems of thought that had been created under Porfirio Díaz in the 19th century, that social Darwinist thought, thought that very oftentimes revolved around the formalist theology of the upper echelons of the Catholic Church, thought that still very oftentimes resided in the metaphysics of German idealism, of French idealism especially, one can begin to understand why Moisés Sáenz would think that thought had very little to do with what was happening practically on the floor of Mexican society, where there was 95% poverty rate, where public government was not working on behalf of people, where Mexico was confronted by the imperialism of the United States, where there was no thought being given to the kind of modernist inflections of modern of social science that we associate with Boas, that we associate with Veblen, and that took the old social Darwinist thought and flipped it on its face and said, it's not biology that is responsible for the creation of hierarchy. It's institutional process that is. So for Moisés Sáenz, pragmatism became a wedge. It became an opening. It gave him permission to question the old systems of thought that had pervaded Mexico in the 19th century. That's the reason that he wanted to study with Dewey. That's the reason that it became important to him. I can talk about public education in a second, if you want.
Yeah, let me ask you about Ralph Ramírez.
Rafael Ramírez was a partisan of the nationalist state, and he is known in Mexico as El Maestro de las Américas, the school teacher of the Americas. If Moisés Sáenz was a high functionary of the Secretary of Public Education beginning in 1926, if he represented a theoretician who had taken pragmatism and tried to blend it with the everyday structures of social process in Mexico, Rafael Ramírez was the engineer. He was the technologist who put the ideas of pragmatism to work in the Mexican countryside. It was he who had the heavy labor of translating pragmatism as Dewey had formulated it in his books, as Moisés Sáenz was importing it into the agencies of the Mexican state. It was Ramírez who had to find a way to convince the school teachers to go into the rural areas of the nation and convert that theory into pedagogy.
What does that look like?
Well, initially, it didn't go well. The school teachers realized that they had assumed that many of the rural villagers spoke Spanish, and they did not. they spoke Otomi, or they were still speaking in some of the Maya dialects. And they realized that they needed to go back to Mexico City and become bilingual themselves first, or they would never be able to even consider the possibility of taking ideas about citizenry and the nation and put them to work in the rural areas of the countryside. These confrontations were sometimes violent. And so the school teachers, the functionaries of the state had to test the political waters in local communities to make sure that villagers throughout the country, wherever it is that they were moving, were actually sympathetic to the political goals of the new government. And one could not take it for granted that that was so. In part, that's because the revolutionary process was never a top-down integrated structure. It had emanated from below, and it had taken place throughout the provinces of the republic. And one could never be sure, without very careful treading, how particular political sensibilities would work out in any one community in the republic. It meant that Rafael Ramirez had to find a way to take the budget of the state and buy the pedagogical instruments that could be put to work in rural areas. If you needed to go into the mountains, if you needed to go into the jungles of Yucatan, how were you going to get those materials out into the new schoolhouses that were being constructed? There were no roads. There were no airplanes. It was a massive undertaking. And these were the everyday realities that that Rafael Ramirez was confronted with and that he worked with day to day until the moment that he died. It's for this reason that he's considered the Maestro de las Americas, the teacher of the Americas, precisely because he had to come down from the level of ideas into the mechanics of institutional process. This was fundamental and pragmatist thought.
It seems like just a massive experiment here of trying to apply pragmatic thought and education from Dewey to and building a nation through this education system. It is. I was pretty stunned at the effort that that would take.
It was a huge experiment. Very few people could foresee what Mexico would look like 20 years hence, 30 years hence. The political pressure was on Mexico to rebuild its infrastructure and to unify itself as a nation precisely because it needed to counter the force of the United States to its north. But it was an experiment to the extent that nobody had ever conceptualized the possibility of making Mexico a de facto nation of citizens. Porfirio Diaz had constructed the federal state, but with poverty rates in excess of 90%, with the use of the rural federales, the rurales, the police force, and the use of violence that Porfirio used to keep people in check in the late 19th century, without an infrastructure that could move resources back and forth across the nation, Mexico did not exist as the nation state that it exists at today. And that was going to be, post-revolutionary intellectuals theorized, a necessity to counter the weight of the United States as it was rising to superpower status in the North. It was an experiment. It was an experiment because the state was being built at the same time that the public schools were being established. It was an experiment because here you are importing pragmatism from Columbia University and trying to put it to work in the rural areas of the country. It was an experiment because people were trying to move back the political power of the Catholic Church, and nobody knew how that was going to work out on the ground. Massive experimentation happening all at once in thousands of communities across the republic.
Because you're building, in a way, it's also easier because they didn't have any structures. And so you're building from scratch instead of trying to go and modify things that were already there.
That's
in
right.
In terms of education.
That's right. The only places in the republic that had public schools were the metropolitan areas. And even there were not very many.
Okay.
And so one had to create the schoolhouse for the first time in the history of Mexico. in the provinces for the first time in the 20th century. Now, that isn't necessarily an easy thing to do. You had to convince rural villages that the public school was an institution that was favorable to their communities.
Right, and also the method of teaching, in the way you describe it, was trying to use the local knowledge, the everyday knowledge of the people, as a means to teach.
Let's go back to...
That method is very interesting to me.
Yeah, let's go back to Dewey. If it's true that the old philosophical systems has separated them separated themselves from the everyday texture of local life, and if it was true that one could not find some ontological utopia as the pragmatists thought, then the only solution for creating a social consensus, the only solution for creating political community, was the texture of everyday life itself. And pragmatism depended on the notion of pluralism, of difference, of diversity, in part because diversity was an organic fact of social existence all over North America. You had different communities. Each one brought its own ontology. It brought its own life practices. It brought its own ways of being, of thinking, to bear on political systems. And how was one going to judge, right, which of all those vibrant possibilities was the best system for a republic in the making that was going to be made out of many, many different kinds of peoples? Well, one ultimately could not decide among them unless one tested them as part of a social consensus. That is, that you had to use local tradition, local custom, because that was the only building block out of which to build a larger structure of unity. It was a very long process in Deweyan thought. It was a process of consensus building. It was a process of discussion. It was a process of experimentalism, is what he said. It was a process of using science, that is, things that were testable in the real world, as a part of this larger project to create political unity. It was also an open-ended process. One could never arrive at a final solution to a political community, for example, because change was organic to the social world. Technology came up to the fore at particular moments, for example, and that rendered transformation in the social structure. There were new ideas that were being born constantly by people. And so you had to make some kind of room for the presence of that sort of change. That meant that you had to be continuously open to the transformation of society as one moved across time.
Ruben, I want to ask you about the scientific state, the Mexican scientific state, and its relationship to positivism, which, you know, was very important under Diaz and before that. You know, 19th century Latin America, positivism is sort of the philosophy that kind of rules. What is the connection between positivism and pragmatism? And did it prepare Mexican thinkers to accept or embrace pragmatism in any way?
There is a relationship between these two modes of scientific thought, and positivism was itself based in English and French scientism. The difference is that positivism was a more closed universe to the question of change than was pragmatism. Positivism existed in mid to late 19th century Mexico, and it could not account for assumed that biology was the ultimate arbiter of social construction. And as such, it adopted theories of social Darwinism to explain hierarchy in modern society. pragmatism was a part of the modernist movement of ideas that also included cultural relativism by Franz Boas, that included Thorsten Veblen's economic thought, that included the historicism of Charles Beard. And it placed its emphasis not on biology, but on institutional structures, right, as the determinants of hierarchy. Positivism became ossified in Mexico because its partisans borrowed from schools of thought that placed the emphasis on human nature rather than on institutional process. And so although there is a relationship between these two modes of thinking, pragmatism actually represented a modern school of thought that overturned positivism in Mexico and elsewhere. It did so in the United States. It had done so earlier in Europe. My larger point is that Mexico, after the revolution, is partaking of the same modernist flow of ideas that had taken place in the United States and had taken place in Europe. And so that Mexico, although we tend to think of it as an anti-U.S. case, as an example of a nation that is antithetical to America, is actually not so. It was partaking of exactly the same schools of thought.
Right. Yeah, there's a whole movement of ideas that are going throughout Latin America and through into the United States and back again and around and across the Atlantic.
That's right. So
it's not an isolated
That's right.
World. Okay, so you've got Sainz and you've got Ramirez. They're trying to apply, they're applying Dewey's philosophy of education to Mexico. And then Mexico sort of emerges as sort of a laboratory, a living laboratory, which allows U.S. intellectuals and thinkers about education to go and observe and see how it works. I think this is brilliant.
The episode that most riveted me, it's also the episode that took me back to the civil rights movement.
Which is this connection here, I think, is just the sweet spot of your book. This is just, I love it. It's the sweet spot.
Well, thank you for saying so. I think if one steps out of the morality of the civil rights movement, and that is central. One cannot think of the civil rights movement without thinking of public ethics and what is right in U.S. society. But it has such a weight to it. It is so important in 20th century American thought that one can forget that mechanically, that sociologically, that the civil rights movement is a kind of movement in the direction of a melting pot. That is, we are blending peoples together in public institutions. And we think that that's a good thing. We think that that's a virtue. Civil rights has a depressing history after the 1960s. And we all live with that. But we can forget that at the level of sociology in the 30s and 40s and 50s, the creation of a single citizen bloc in the United States was taking place through public institutions. The government had thrown its weight behind that movement. And that represented part of this larger question of the melting pot in American history. Why were Americans interested in Mexico? Because Mexico had begun experimenting with its own melting pot in the 1920s. That is, throwing the weight of the federal state behind the public institution, behind public government, earlier than the United States had done during its civil rights movement. There's a period of 10 to 15 years in which Mexico was out front in the kind of social scientific questions that would later preoccupy the leaders of the civil rights movement in the United States. And so if one thinks about it, it just kind of makes sense. Mexico is very close to New Mexico. It's very close to Texas, to Arizona, and California. One could travel from San Diego into Tijuana or Baja California, or from El Paso through Ciudad Juarez to Ciudad Chihuahua, and see the experiments in the public schools unfolding on the ground. It was not a difficult journey to make. And once you arrive in the province of Mexico, you see the public school teacher trying to harness varieties of communities together in the effort to create a single citizenship bloc. You see the public school teacher embarked on ideological projects of nation building, nationalism, What is the nation? Should it be Spanish? Should it be Otomi? Should it be one of the Mayan dialects? These are all the texture and the fabric of nationalism in the making, and it resonated with the Americans because they had similar questions in the United States.
Okay, you've talked about a group of Americans who went to Mexico to study the reform that was going on in Mexico. You've got the educator George Sanchez, psychologist Lloyd Tarman, and anthropologist Rafael Beals. Can you talk about these folks and others that you mentioned?
These are fascinating people.
They were there not. They were just there for a month. They were there for years.
They spent a great quantities of time in Mexico because they discovered that that social scientific thought could only raise more questions about institutional process, and that studying institutional process required years and years of heavy thought and heavy practice. Sanchez was interesting. He was from New Mexico, and as a young boy, he spent time with his mother and father working in the mines of Arizona. This is part of the similar migration patterns that other historians like Sarah Deutsch have discovered for Mexican immigrants to the United States. As industry is changing, as the economy is changing in the American West, there is cyclical migration in and out of rural to metropolitan areas or out of rural into industrial zones. For Sanchez, working in or being with his family in the mining centers of Arizona was an introduction to multiculturalism, because you had miners that had come from all over the world, Latin America included. It was also an introduction to Marxist and socialist thought, patterns of thinking that were different from the democratic thought that he had begun to learn in the public schools. This was one of the experiential bases for his interest in the melting pot. Another was his time spent in rural New Mexico. Rural New Mexico was historically Spanish language based, and it traced its history back to the Spanish colonial empire and to the Republic of Mexico rather than to the eastern United States. But the fact was that in the early 19-teens, when Sanchez was a young child, you could see the flow of American immigrants from the south and from the north into Arizona, into California, into New Mexico. And it raised the question of how does one create a single unified community out of so many different constituent elements? Tyerman and Beals represent generations of social scientists who, like Sanchez, are interested in very similar questions. Tyerman was not from the West, but originally from Iowa. Iowa, however, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, was experiencing immigration from Northern Europe, from Norway, from Wales, from the Scandinavian countries. And if you step back and look, there too you have this question of the melting pot. Tyerman's solution was to study educational psychology. As pragmatists and other psychologists were developing it on the East Coast of the United States. There was a relationship between psychology and philosophy and pragmatism because they were trying to figure out how the mind worked. How did one take the raw stuff of biology, the brain as an organ of biology, and convert that into ideas, the flow? How did one put ideas down on paper, and what was the relationship to biology? This is part of the attempt to break out of the utopias of thought that had resided in 19th century idealism. So Tyerman's relationship to philosophy was through psychology, especially understanding how one acquired language and how one translated across linguistic structures, Spanish to English or Norwegian to Welsh.
And that was very important in Mexico, of course, because you got all these different languages, so it's a great place to study how this happens.
It's a perfect analog to what was happening in Iowa, and eventually he ends up at the University of New Mexico because that's where he got his start as a young psychologist inside of the School of Education at the University of New Mexico. And from New Mexico, he discovered the Republic of Mexico. I don't yet know precisely what it is that tuned him into experimentation south of the Rio Grande. I've not found any account in a letter or a book of his in which he describes how he discovered that the Secretary of Public Education was doing the kind of work that it was doing. But once he discovered that it was taking place, the analogy was a perfect match to the kinds of questions that he was asking himself in the United States. Beals was an anthropologist from Kansas whose family had gone to California. He came from a socialist family. And so they were very interested in the price of industrial processes in the Midwest and then in the West. His father and mother in California were very interested in industrial unions. And here's the question of how does one rebalance the economy given the kind of industrial growth that was happening and that was taking place before the New Deal state when we had unionism, right, as a part of the economic fabric of the nation. All of this in California was taking place, of course, in the context of migration from Mexico into California, the heavy migration from the south into the Los Angeles basin, which is where Beals first went to. His answer was the discovery of cultural relativism at the University of California. He was a young writer. He wanted to be a writer rather than an anthropologist. And so these rich series of beautiful short stories that he put together at the age of 15, 16, 17. His brother was Carlton Beals, the radical journalist. And so this strain of writing ran deeply in his generation, of his family generation, his brother. It was through the study of the art of writing that he discovered anthropology at the University of California. And one of the neat things that you see in the anthropological archives in Washington, D.C., where he donated all of his papers after his career as an anthropologist at UCLA, is the thought processes that converted him from a writer into an anthropologist. He realized that he did not know enough about the cultural structure of any particular community in California. And he decided to take anthropology courses in order to gain some sense of the rich tapestry of life that any one community represented. And he was going to put that to work in his stories. But he became so fascinated with cultural relativism, which was just washing over the field. This was Franz Boas and modernism and social science at Columbia radiating outward to the West Coast. That he was enamored instantaneously with cultural relativism and what anthropology could tell you about human community. For him, cultural relativism became the way to reimagine social structure, to reimagine it away from the heavy price that people were paying for industrialization without trade unionism, without socialism, without Marxism.
And Mexico is a fabulous place for an anthropologist with all these different ethnic groups to really study these processes.
And the relationship to the state and relationship to the economy, right.
It seems just like a natural place to go. Now, they learn a lot, that these Americans who go down to Mexico and just to kind of observe and study what's going on in Mexico and how it's developing, they come back, they're bringing back things to their experiences to the United States.
That's right.
And the battles that are going on between school desegregation, multiple battles in courts and in court cases.
Public mobilization.
Yes. So, talk about what happens with their knowledge that they gain and that they bring back.
Well, let me say first that I want to make clear that the civil rights movement was a broad-based movement, and that the individuals that I'm studying here who have spent time in Mexico and then brought their ideas back to the United States represented only one of many constituencies that were interested in the civil rights movement. And so, yes, you had labor unrest, and you had labor activists. Emma Tenayuca, for example, is a famous example of that. Ernesto Galarza is another example of the same thing. They were the trade unionists of California. You also had mobilization during the Great Depression and the World War because of all the economic change, and people are migrating hither and thither. So there are many different people who begin thinking about the question of civil rights, which essentially means opening up public institutions that have been previously closed to immigrant groups, to Black Americans, to the marginalized. It was an accident, as I look on the careers of these social scientists, that they become interested in civil rights, because before the mobilization of the civil rights movement, they had primarily been social scientific actors who were working within universities and were busily transforming social scientific thought within specific departments of the university as they were being developed. So, for example, let's take the case of Beals. He was an anthropologist. He was the founder of the Department of Anthropology at UCLA. And initially, when they started the department, it was both a sociology and an anthropology department simultaneously. The questions that he brought to cultural relativism were worked out in the classrooms. He, as a professor, lecturing to students. That was also the case for Lloyd Tyerman, who was training young graduate students in educational psychology. Very interested in how the brain functions, very interested in how one creates ideas out of the biology of the brain. And he, too, is primarily translating these kinds of ideas for audiences within units of the university. It is the case that because of all of the rapid change in 1930s and 1940s America, that that they cannot remain immune from all the unrest that is enveloping California, New Mexico, Arizona, the Deep South, the urban North. And for them, the fact that they are studying cultural relativism, the fact that they're studying pragmatism means one thing, that there is a necessary relationship between ideas and political action.
This reminds me of, they're kind of being forced by circumstance to become not just intellectuals, but public intellectuals by intervening in the world outside the academy.
Absolutely. I think of the people that I study, I think Sanchez thought of himself as a public intellectual because he found himself having to write to newspapers so often about the conditions of immigrants from Mexico and New Mexico and about the Spanish language communities of New Mexico that trace their history back to the Spanish Empire. So to the extent that he had to do this publicly in front of public school officials, yes, he was a public intellectual from the get-go. Tyerman didn't care at all about being a public intellectual. He was a scientist, and that's where his thought, that's where his ethic, that's where his feeling of self was rooted. It was in the laboratory. It was in the classroom. And he was not the kind of individual who felt very comfortable stepping beyond it. Nonetheless, the fact that social science, as he was developing it, was applicable to questions of cultural pluralism, to questions of cultural exchange, these became necessary components of the court battles that are represented in the civil rights cases. One had to ask questions about English and the Spanish language and how those work simultaneously together in the public schools if one was going to create a school system that included both Mexican-American and white American students in the same classrooms. If one set of students came to school speaking primarily Spanish and another came to school speaking primarily English, then how did that get reconciled by the school itself? This was a necessary question for social scientists to answer. Ralph Beals, because he wanted to be a writer, I think always, if he didn't think of himself as a public intellectual, knew that his audience was going to be outside of academy. And so I think if you look on his life, one of the things that distinguishes his career is a very deep concern with the wages of the social process among all of the peoples that he lived with. So immigrants, the industrial labor forces of California, indigenous communities in Mexico, especially the Yaqui, in which he specialized. And so even as he's writing his books for colleagues, he's very interested in the role that public institutions perform in creating a balance of peoples. I should step back and say that had it not been for the kind of social scientific thought, just a few minutes ago we were talking about the relationship between positivism and pragmatism. And this is key. Modernist thought in social sciences for these individuals gave them the permission that they needed to involve themselves in the work of public institutions. It was experimentation. It was scientism. It was empiricism. It was the testing out of ideas on the ground that mattered in the new modernist social scientific thought. And so for them, there was no collision between ideas in universities and the creation of institutions in public spaces. Those were necessarily locked together in a dialectical relationship. And they were never afraid to try to work out ideas in the realm of the public.
Now, the civil rights movement that they were end up getting involved in through different court cases and things like this was not just the South in the Southwest, but also it also involved, I think, one of these, which one was it that was very really involved in the South? With Africa,
George Sanchez.
Sanchez, okay, very much involved in African American rights, civil rights there, and what that's going to mean.
That's right. Sanchez would later go on in the late 1940s, and then in the 1950s, in the years that are leading to Brown versus Board of Education, would become an intellectual who integrated himself into the political campaigns of the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. These were two of the principal organizations that were leading the fight for the integration of the public schools for Black Americans in the Deep South and in Kansas, which is where the Brown case emanates, out of Topeka, Kansas. But Sanchez's segue into the civil rights movement of the 1950s at the level of law was predated by the fact that in the 1930s, the research money for his trip to Mexico had come from the Rosenwald Fund of Chicago. And this is the same Rosenwald Fund created by Julius Rosenwald, who is known for the creation of private schools throughout the Deep South as one answer to the horrific race relations, the structure of violence of the New South. Rosenwald had funded private schools throughout the Deep South, and there's an enormous collection that is housed at Fisk University that contains the archives of this enormous campaign to create public schools that would benefit African-American students in the Deep South. It was precisely because Rosenwald was interested in interracial relationships between whites and blacks that they began to look outside of the Deep South for potential models of public education, of private education, to put to work in Mississippi, Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina. When they learned about New Mexico as a site of experimentation. Here we're talking about, for example, Sanchez, who has come back from UC Berkeley, who is interested in interracial relationships in New Mexico. When Rosenwald learned that there were models of interracial thinking and practice taking place in other places in the United States, they turned to Sanchez, and he became one of their functionaries. Rosenwald, through Sanchez, became interested in what was happening in the Republic of Mexico. And so it was they who gave him the money, right, to travel in Mexico for the initial 2 years that it took to write Mexico, a Revolution by Education. This was a text that Sanchez wrote in 1936 about the Mexican state's public education system. It was Rosenwald who sent Sanchez from New Mexico into Louisiana to begin at Grambling University to translate Mexico's institutional models into the Southern scene, to put those same models to work among African Americans and white Americans in rural Louisiana. What you have, if you just step back, is a triangular relationship that's taking place here. In the American West, in the American South, and in Mexico.
It's really great. I really just love this. I you know, you've been really great today, and you've given our listeners a lot to think about. Maybe they'll go and read the book now, because I think the book is very interesting. I have a final question for you. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm basking right now in the fact that I completed this book. And so I'm doing a lot of deep reading. I've become very interested in the migration of women from Mexico into the United States between 1920 and 1950. And here's the structural question that I have that I think may end up becoming a book. The structural question is, how did society organize itself in far northern Mexico? Of course, you have the national state that's trying to recreate public institutions. You have the mobilization of resources. But you also have a huge amount of male death because of the revolution. Men were killed in the war. And there is a surplus of women. And the women begin to migrate from rural Mexico into the cities. So the city of Parral, the city of Torreon, the city of Ciudad Juarez. In many cases, the story turns out to be initially a very sad story of women who have children, but of men who have multiple families, right? And this is because the gender ratios are imbalanced. I'm very interested in the lives of these women as they move northward and as they come into the United States. And I'm trying to find a way to tell that story. When women come into El Paso before moving into San Antonio, somehow they harness the fortitude to maintain family structures. And as women migrate into the United States, they remarry, very oftentimes with Americans, and they have second families. This is a sociological phenomenon. I can't wrap my head around it completely yet, but it happens in multiple locations. I'd like to do something with that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ruben. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And please read the book. It holds together pretty tightly, I think. And I think I'm thrilled to get this award. So,
thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Drop me a line at newbooks.americanstudies@gmail.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.